Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. I really appreciate it. Let people know about the programme if you enjoy it, because it is hard sometimes to find a good science programme. But I'm always heartened by the comments I get, meet people a lot the last couple of weeks, people saying, love the programme. Love to hear that. Let other people know, though. It's great. Don't keep it to yourself. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us, or at Newstalk Science. I've been banging on about it, but if you have seen the reaction from people, you would be interested, because I've been running these workshops called Get Started With AI, because I felt like people who are like working for themselves, or professionals trying to improve their career, or small to medium enterprises, all these organizations are sort of being left behind a bit when it comes to AI. So I set up this workshop called Get Started With AI. It's a 2-hour workshop where you can learn how to use the tools of ChatGPT and lots of other programs to get stuff done in a really effective way, because these programs are getting so good now. If you'd like to know more, you can find out about our Cork and Galway dates on getstartedai.com. Okay, on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about the male contraceptive. And it's not just a pill that's on the horizon. It's lots of different things. Some of them sound quite weird, but the future of male contraception is fascinating. We're going to be talking about it in a bit. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me in studio is Dr. Annie Curtis from the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, and from Research Ireland, Dr. Ruth Freeman. You're both very welcome. Ruth, our first story has to do with a comet that we haven't seen since the Stone Age.
Yep, this comet has not been around since the Neanderthals walked the Earth around 80,000 years ago. So a comet is a big ball of ice, and it was spotted last year by astronomers. So its name, I'm not going to pronounce it right. It's Comet C/2023A3 Chuchitan Atlas. I probably got that totally wrong. But anyway, it's probably sort of, it has this very elongated orbit, so it only comes past the Earth very, very rarely. It's probably come from this kind of comet belt out past Neptune. And when astronomers spotted it last year, they thought we were going to get a very good view. But of course, as the comet gets closer to the sun, you know, chances are it can start to melt, it can start to break up. So we weren't sure how good a view we would get of it at its closest point to us. But it looks like we're going to get a pretty good view over the coming week. It should be visible with the naked eye. And if you have a telescope, you should even be able to see that kind of classic comet tail there. So it's sort of stayed big enough. So we're likely to get really good views of it in the coming weeks.
Comets, is it just ice? Or is there anything else in it?
Ice, space dust? Dust, yeah, all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, yeah, but it's mostly ice. And you know, these comets, they formed right back at the birth of the solar system. You know, they've been, probably were huge, bigger blocks of ice, and they've been moving around. So this could be over 4 billion years old, this comet. It's been knocking around for a long time, but it just has this very unusual orbit where we only see it very, very rarely.
Yeah, why is that? Why do we see it so rarely? Because I didn't realise, you know, You could take, I didn't think anything would come back after 80,000 years.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. And obviously it's just looking at the orbit path that they can identify that this is the last time. Obviously we've no records of it being seen before. So it's just because it has this very unusual orbit path that takes it way, way out beyond Neptune, and it slings very far out from our solar system, and it's coming back. So it's just by mapping the trajectory that we can estimate that the last time it would have been seen was 80,000 years ago.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Any idea how big it is?
No.
No. Big.
Big enough to see.
Big enough to see,
yeah. And it hasn't broken up, even though it's gone like relatively close to the sun. It kind of went between us and the sun, so that's
right.
Quite close.
Yeah.
And yeah, we'll get good views of it. So if you look online, I think it's the 13th of October is the best day to see it. But you'll be able to find out whether it's going to be morning time or evening time, because depending on where you are, there'll be better places to see it. But if you want to see it, 13th of October, telescopes and binoculars out.
And if you miss it, you've a long way to wait. Will it be another 80,000 years?
If it survives that long, I guess. Yeah.
Right, okay. Gosh, that's very fatalistic, Ruth. Our second story has to do with some funny chemistry.
Indeed. Indeed, Jonathan. So this was a very different study for me to read, because I'm a biologist and this was a chemistry type paper. So I'm not going to lie, I had quite a bit of difficulty in reading the original paper, but I kind of pieced it all together. And basically what it's about is carbon bonds. So if you remember from your kind of chemistry class, you'd have kind of carbon and a matchstick and another carbon and another and matchsticks around the place. And what they were was basically these covalent bonds. And what has been dogma about these covalent bonds is that they are made up of electrons. Okay, so kind of go back a step as well. If we think about a carbon, it's an atom. It's kind of like the basic piece of life, the bits of life that all join together to make molecules and life and all of that. And what we find is, you know, in the middle of your atom, you've got your neutrons and your protons. And then outside, then you've got these electrons.
Yeah.
And these electrons kind of whisk around. You know, we're thinking about orbits, so it's a nice segue from Ruth's piece. But they talk more about they move sort of in clouds, okay? And the way that two atoms will come together is by sort of these electrons coming together. So kind of think about it like almost hands. So the electrons sort of like join hands.
Yeah.
And just like that, they can stay together for a while or they can actually break apart.
And this is how molecules are made.
Absolutely. This is chemistry 101. So the finding here, though, is that what has always been thought is it's always been pairs of electrons that kind of move around together, right? And that's what forms this covalent bond. And what's kind of been, you know, a groundbreaking discovery is they've actually found that this covalent bond can form with just one electron. And that has been found with other atoms, like phosphorus, I think, and some other atoms, but had never been found with carbon. And I suppose carbon kind of makes it's kind of the big daddy in terms of all the atoms, because it's pretty much what all life is made of. Like, we are here because we are made of carbon, and everything that's organic is made of carbon. Mm. So the fact that we can see just this single electron forming the covalent bond is kind of a big deal. Now, you would say, what's the application for this? But I think, you know, this is one of these studies where there is no application. This is just understanding nature and the curiosity of nature and revealing things, you know, that are beautiful within nature.
But as we build drugs, for example, or as we look at how things stick together in organic science, we see, you know, carbon making these bonds in a very predictable way. And that's what those sort of those diagrams we see in school books are.
Exactly.
And so, as you say, carbon being this absolutely fundamental element to all living life, the idea that it can form in a completely new way, and we're only discovering that in 2024, is extraordinary. And it being so fundamental, it's actually quite difficult to understand what this discovery means.
Yeah, like, I suppose you think about it, it will make the textbooks. You know, it'll be something now that will be put into the textbooks.
Not primary school, presumably.
Not primary.
And probably not even secondary school.
Considering I couldn't really read the paper, I'm not sure, you know, which textbook it's going to go into. But anyway.
You put yourself forward for this, Joy, I'd like to point out.
I wonder why
I'll do that one.
I questioned myself after it. But I think what it sort of just shows is, yeah, like, there's still so much that we don't know about how these atoms work. But I would say, in order for them to see this, it wasn't kind of easy. You know what I mean? It wasn't like stick two carbons together and woohoo, there you see it. They actually had to kind of build almost a cage of carbons around two carbons and then stretch those two carbons out. And then that's when they saw one electron click off and the other electron go around.
And, you know, when we look at the fundamental building blocks of our everything that we see around us, matter. These things are really important, right?
Yeah.
How these things are made, subatomic particles and atomic particles, how they interact. That is, you know, that is our understanding of the universe. So it's always interesting when something something that sounds so familiar to us is actually much more mysterious than we thought.
And if you think about AI trying to come up with things like new molecules and proteins, but it's trained on what we know.
Absolutely.
And you're putting new information in,
this
you're opening
new model
up possibilities.
Yep.
Yeah, for a few things, for sure.
Ruth, our third story, a little less challenging, it's about space bacteria.
It's about space bacteria. Now, when we think about the ISS and we see footage from the ISS, we might immediately sort of think it's sterile up there or space is somewhat sterile. But of course, it's not. Because humans go up to the ISS and they exist in this microgravity environment. All the stuff that the humans need and stuff to do experiments with go up. And even though those things are sterilized before they go up, they're not fully sterilized.
So you can't sterilize a human.
You can't sterilize a human.
Well, you can, but not in this way. And to actually make a human sterile before, like, fully their whole body, no bacteria,
germ free,
they would die. They would die very quickly.
Exactly. So not surprisingly, microbes have got into the International Space Station and some of them have taken up residence there quite comfortably. And over the past couple of decades, NASA has been keeping an eye on what's been growing in various different cracks and crevices in the international...
This is the beginning of a horror movie.
Space, it kind of is. And a paper, it hasn't actually been published, it's sort of a preprint at the moment, it's been published on BioArchive, has found six sort of new bacteria, but they're new, they're adapted bacteria. They've evolved from other bacteria that went up there before. And what the team
did was... hang on, they've evolved in space.
They've evolved, they've adapted to space. I mean, it's unclear exactly where the line is. Are they totally new species of bacteria? I mean, but they're gram-positive bacteria, which means they stain with a particular type of staining that we have. They have these thick cell walls. And the team at NASA used kind of a deep learning tool to do a detailed analysis of the full set of proteins that these bacteria have. And they found similarities between these six very different types of bacteria. That they were similar, all the ones that had evolved in space, but that were different to their closest relatives on Earth. And it was interesting because when they looked at the types of proteins that were there, they seemed to be adaptive. So there was ones that looked at the kind of, obviously bacteria have to deal with osmosis because they're kind of like bags of liquid. And in a microgravity environment, that's more challenging for them. So there was proteins that helped them to keep their integrity in that microgravity environment. They also had more proteins that were involved in DNA repair. And again, you're exposed to more radiation when you're in space. So it kind of makes sense that they would be adapting to that. They also had mobile genetic elements. So little bits of DNA that jump around the genome and that can help with them, their metabolism. So they're obviously struggling to metabolize as effectively as they would here on Earth. And the other thing they saw was kind of small molecules and little bits of peptide. And this is probably the most interesting bit because that's associated with being pathogenic or being disease causing. Mm. And they have found in studies previously that there seemed to be an increased pathogenicity with bacteria that are adapting to this tough environment in space because they're basically getting tougher.
Yeah.
Because they're surviving in a harsh environment.
So we're going to be talking about evolution a little bit later in the programme. But this is fascinating that we have, put an organism in a hostile environment, a completely new environment of zero gravity. Presumably, even the chemical makeup of the inside of the International Space Station is very different to whatever the bacteria would have been used to, the armpit of the...
But even the light-dark cycle, if you think about it, so you're coming from a 24-hour, solar, Earth solar system here, you go up to space... You're going around.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a huge difference as well.
And do you think it would affect the bacteria?
Oh, yeah.
Huh. All right.
That's what made them more pathogenic, I think.
Oh, very interesting.
Could be. No sleep.
Could be. Who knows?
No sleep.
We're going to write the script for this movie after this. Our final story, Annie, has to do with a reversal of diabetes.
Yeah, so this is a fascinating story and in a journal that I could actually follow this time. So it was published in a journal called Cell, which is like one of the big daddy journals, and from a group of scientists in China. And basically what they did was they took cells from a lady who had type 1 diabetes, they reprogrammed them back to stem cells, and then they made them into beta cells, which basically is what your parts of your pancreas is made out of. And they were able to cure this lady's type 1 diabetes. So I suppose to break it down a little bit, what are we talking about here? So when we're talking about reprogrammed stem cells, if we think about cells in our body that we can see, like our skin cells, they're all cells that like, they already have an identity. You know, I'm a skin cell, I'm an eye cell, all of that, just like you're Jonathan and you're Ruth. But a stem cell has basically been kind of deprogrammed out of all of that identity. And they can become any other cell that they want.
Yeah, I kind of like to think of it as like a blank Scrabble piece.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, is it? I'm sorry. great minds. Anyway.
So it is. It's like the blank tile in Scrabble, right? So you have these pieces that have letters on them and that's all fantastic. And they're an L and they're an M. So that's your skin and whatever. And then you've got this blank piece that can become anything. Hmm. So that's your stem cell. And back in about 2007, 2008, there was this major study where they were able to take cells and reprogram them back into stem cells and then move them into whatever way they wanted to.
Yeah.
So in this study, what they basically did was, which was very unique, is they took the lady's own fat cells, they put them back into stem cell-like, and then they made them into these beta cells, and then they kind of put these beta cells together to make kind of like grapes, and that was basically their islets of Langerhans, which is a part of the pancreas that creates insulin. And this was the key thing then. Then what they did was, which is I think is amazing, they just implanted the cells kind of underneath your rib bones here, and they were able to monitor these cells, and they started producing insulin. And I suppose out of all the hormones that we think that are so important, and this is why pancreatic cancer is so detrimental, it's insulin. So after, you know, a couple of days, these cells started to produce insulin. Within a couple of weeks, this lady no longer needed injected insulin. And within a year, you know, she was talking about the fact that she could eat sugar again, that she loves hot pot, all of that. Fantastic study.
Amazing. Dr. Annie Curtis from Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland. Thanks very much. Now, like fusion power, male contraception is the wave of the future that has stayed in the future, always about 10 to 15 years away, no matter what decade we've been living in. But unlike fusion, it seems finally that may no longer be the case with the number of approaches already in the human trial phase. So what is coming down the line? Well, Logan Nichols is Chief Research Officer with the Male Contraceptive Initiative. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Logan. What is the Male Contraceptive Initiative?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Male Contraceptive Initiative is a nonprofit, a non-governmental organization based in the U.S., and it funds research into male contraceptive options, trying to get these sort of products moving further along in the pipeline towards market and towards the hands of people who can actually use them.
Is it like motivated individuals, or is it a consortia of researchers and people who want to commercialize? Like, it sounds like a strange thing to tie your mask to as a nonprofit, but is it like a lobbying group? Is that the idea?
We have an advocacy angle to the organization, but we primarily fund research.
Oh, wow.
We really do everything we can to try and get these things moving towards the market, because we know that there's not only a research lift necessary to actually move the products and generate things that people can use, but also a social lift that's going to be necessary in terms of sensitizing the public, in terms of advocating for policies that make these sort of products easily accessible, things like that. So it's really a broad approach on our side.
All right. So where are we at with contraceptives? What sort of things are in clinical trials at the moment, and how promising are they?
There's a couple of different options in clinical trials right now. I like to break things up into three different buckets, really.
Okay.
There's hormonal male contraceptives in clinical trials right now. They're being tested for like a gel that men rub on their shoulders once a day. That's in a later stage clinical trial.
What?
And then there's a couple of, yeah, absolutely. It's a novel delivery mechanism, right?
Wow. You rub a gel on your shoulders? Why would you do that?
So it's a way to make sure that the drug is actually transferred into the skin more easily. So it's a formulation they've tried to formulate through oral methods or other approaches. But the way the body metabolizes the drug, it just, the delivery mechanism didn't quite work out. And so the way that this works is it's a gel that you rub on the shoulders, and that is slow, the active ingredients of the gel are slowly absorbed through the skin, which increases the pharmacokinetics of the approach and makes it a little more tolerable for a once a day method instead of something that you maybe would have to take as a pill a couple of times a day.
Okay. And would you like rub yourself on the shoulders first and then go out that night? What's the delay in efficacy?
Oh, this is a great question. So because it's a hormonal method, hormonal methods actually stop the generation of new sperm. And so because of that, it actually takes quite a bit of time. There's actually a 3-month or so lead time that men would have to take this product before they actually saw contraceptive efficacy. It's the similar sort of thing for a vasectomy. There's a waiting period after you have the procedure before it becomes effective. That would be the same for this sort of product.
Wait, I'm rubbing my shoulders with gel 3 months before I can, you know, I can use this product.
Contraception. Yeah, absolutely. So that's, you know, it's one of the things to say that, you know, we can get into the other products as they come up,
but yeah.
There's not any one perfect solution out there. So that's why it's going to be necessary for us to really support multiple methods such that there's ultimately a menu of options that people can use.
You could just wait until you're married. That's a joke.
Yeah.
All right. So, okay. So rubbing shoulders on skin. I mean, have patients been asked whether or not they would do this for 30 days or 90 days before they can actually count on it being effective? Like, that is something I would never, I mean, I would definitely remember to take a pill or put on a condom if I was, if I needed to. But like, what if I skipped a few days in the 90 days? I mean, it's just an extraordinary adherence to that protocol required just to get a contraceptive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to answer your question, firstly, they've actually talked to people that not only have used these methods in clinical trial settings, but people who want to use these methods in hypothetical settings for market research. And in both cases, people say that they're very interested in using these methods. And the people who have actually had experience with them have been excited to use them. They've actually even tried to like re-enroll in studies because they like the method so much. So I think it's one of those things that it's very much a personal preference.
For sure.
But I can also say that it's very important for us to create a menu of options that have that diversity of approaches such that, you know, some people may not be interested in a method that has a 3-month lead time, and some people may be interested in something that with a diverse product characteristics. And then to speak to the robustness of the method, you mentioned, you know, if you miss a day or something, this is actually probably going to be a relatively flexible method where there's tolerability if you miss a day or so. That's part of the the mechanism, right? If you're shutting down spermatogenesis, if it takes a long time for it to shut down, it conversely is going to take a longer time for it to boot back up. And so it won't be that, you know, you can miss maybe a week. You know, we don't want to play around with the edges of efficacy here. But at the same time, it could be that there's a little bit of tolerability with missing a dose or so.
The problem is, like, most of my relationships when I was younger lasted less than 3 months. So by the time I had reached efficacy, I probably wouldn't need it. That's totally on me, by the way. So that's one. I have so many questions, actually. Let's just move to the second one and we might come back, because does the second one also target hormones?
No. So that's actually, the second bucket is a totally different method that I like to put things in, which is vas occlusive devices. And, you know, what does that mean? It's really, it refers to the vas deferens, right, which is the structure that carries sperm from the testes out through the body, through the reproductive tract, and you know, it's what gets cut in a vasectomy. Mm-hmm. And these methods are really similar to a vasectomy in terms of patient experience, but instead of in a vasectomy where they excise a piece of the vas deferens, or they, you know, essentially create a blockage that's through removal of the vas deferens.
Yep.
In this case, they actually inject a hydrogel into the vas deferens that results in a dam of sorts. So that fluid is allowed to pass through, but not sperm cells. And these methods are really similar to a vasectomy in terms of patient experience. They will be ultimately more reversible than vasectomies. That's their benefit, is that they, you know, vasectomy is intended to be a permanent procedure. You can't reliably reverse it, and it's very expensive. And so these methods are either designed to reverse on their own after a set amount of time, or a second procedure would go in and do a reversal. One method is in clinical trials right now, one that degrades on its own after a couple of years. It's actually in clinical trials in Australia, early phase, first in human studies. And so that's very exciting. That's another method that's very different than the hormonal methods can be moving down the pipeline.
Yeah, that sounds a lot more promising, I guess, because it's instant and it lasts for a long time. Of course, it does require, you know, a little bit of surgery, but that sounds a bit, or is it just an injection?
Yeah, it'll be very similar to a vasectomy in terms of patient experience.
Okay, you do have to. So they do actually open you up a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's interesting, but and reversible. What is the third method?
Yeah, the third bucket is non-hormonal methods. And there's one method in clinical trials now that's a non-hormonal method that is actually really similar to the hormonal methods in that it stops sperm production. But instead of doing it by interrupting the signals from the brain to the testes and telling them to stop making new sperm, it actually inhibits a very specific target called retinoic acid receptor alpha. And in doing so, it prevents sperm from being generated. And so it still has that lead time, that 3-month period where you'd have to take the drug before it became effective. But instead of instead of hormones, in this case, we're talking about a small molecule. And then two, instead of a daily dermal gel, we're talking about a daily oral pill.
Okay. All right. Can I ask, do any of these come with an app? You know, some sort of a device that tells you you're good to go? Because that would be my concern, that, you know, that I'm not sure, is it ready yet? Or, you know, is there any way of diagnosing your own sterility?
Yeah, so there are at-home sperm tests that are issued to check like the effectiveness of vasectomy, things like that.
Oh, wow.
And I know that some companies are thinking about how to incorporate those sort of tests into a clinical setting or even a market setting, such that people can have an at-home confirmation of efficacy, especially for things that rely on sperm count. But I should say, too, that there are a number of contraceptives in the pipeline that, you know, are earlier on, not in clinical trials, that maybe don't rely on sperm count as a mechanism. They rely on affecting sperm function, like the sperm's ability to swim or fertilize an egg or things like that.
I was going to ask you about that. That's sperm motility is the name, right? The technical term they use for the ability for sperm to swim. Is that a palatable option for some people? Because I suppose women have been dealing with hormonal treatments a lot longer than men when it comes to contraception. So I don't really, you know, I think we know a bit about hormonal effects on the body, right? Although, have we done a lot of testing on hormonal effects in the men?
Yeah, so we've done a fair amount of investigation on hormonal methods for men. And it seems to that, you know, the method, it depends on exactly which hormones are used and what delivery mechanism, things like that. But generally, the side effects are comparable to hormonal contraception for women. And I should say, too, if you target something like sperm motility, you're actually using a non-hormonal method. And so there's the potential for fewer side effects. You know, it's a much more targeted approach. It's not to say that there won't be side effects. You know, these things have to be tested in clinical trials and really done in large scales to understand exactly what the side effects might be. But just to say there's the potential for fewer in non-hormonal methods.
Yeah. I mean, my follow-on question was, you know, the palatability of these various approaches, because hormonal to me doesn't sound as invasive is the wrong word. I don't know what the correct word would be, but to meddle with the motility of sperm, particularly when we're seeing, you know, fertility rates decrease across the world, you know, messing with motility sounds to me a less preferred option. But I'm wondering, maybe the science is actually really strong in how to, in that it affects only the sperm that are created at that time, or like, how does the motility option work?
Yeah, this is a great discussion. Yeah, so the motility option works via targeting specific enzymes or proteins that are important for sperm's ability to swim. And that's exactly right, that it because it only affects mature sperm, it's unlikely that there will be any lingering effects after you stop taking the drug. And that's because, you know, men make a few million sperm a day. So that means that any sperm that are created are affected by the drug, but sperm that haven't been generated yet, the baseline germ cells or stem cells that make new sperm, as long as you're not affecting them, chances are very good you won't have any lingering, long-lasting effects. And so targeting motility is a really cool, exciting method for one of those reasons. And then secondly, it's really exciting because you could actually potentially have a method that is administered to either men or women. So sperm targeting female contraceptives are also in the pipeline, because oftentimes, mechanisms by which sperm become motile, right? They're swimming, all of those functions when they fertilize an egg, that all happens outside of the male body.
That's right. We learned that in the program, that sperm don't kick in until like they've gone past a couple of hurdles and then they go bananas.
Yeah, exactly. So that's exactly right. So there's so many functions that happen after sperm have been ejaculated that actually women could take a contraceptive that targets some of those sperm functions. You know, so we could be dealing with a situation where we have a unisex contraceptive. Maybe men take a contraceptive that inhibits motility inside their body, and then it prevents those sperm from actually fertilizing egg after ejaculation, or women could take a contraceptive that targets some of those same proteins. It's all very, I don't want to say it's theoretical, hypothetical, because there are actual research projects trying to achieve this right now.
Yeah.
But it's there are a lot more scientific questions than there are when we're talking about impacting sperm count, right? There's not an at-home test to say your sperm aren't motile enough to fertilize an egg. That sort of thing doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
So just to say that it's more challenging from a scientific perspective, but it's also very promising, very exciting, and I think some of the leading science in the field.
Is there research into which of these methods are most attractive to men looking for a contraceptive option? Because, you know, just hearing those different options, the idea of, you know, just putting the sperm to sleep or sort of disabling my sperm, that seems like a little, as an idea, as an approach, it just seems a little less palatable to me than the other ones. Like, is there a ranking in terms of what people say they would like?
You know, it's very interesting. Some of the research that we've done, we actually just came out with some market research that we published in conjunction with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And it's really focuses on what sort of products men are interested in. And it shows that across not just the United States, but also some low and middle income countries, that the primary driver for choice of a male contraceptive is the form in which it comes. So whether it's a pill, an implant, an injectable, something like that.
Wow.
Men don't seem to care as much, you know, broadly speaking, about
how it works. They just all they think about is do I have to take this every day, or do I have to wipe it on my shoulders? Like, this is the same question I'm asking. That's what I'm asking. But you're saying the actual effect or how and the mechanism of it, they're not so concerned about.
Yeah, not as concerned. Huh. And I think that's really important to highlight, because you know, when we talk about men, you know, you mentioned you're more reticent to take a certain method.
Yeah.
I think that we have to think about men as there's 4 billion of them on this planet, and they're not a monolith, right? There's going to be men that want a certain method, men that don't want a certain method, men that think that, you know, I mentioned reversible vasectomies and vas occlusive devices. Some men may be very turned off by that for the same reason that men are turned off by vasectomy today.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important for us to create a diversity of options such that we don't treat men as a monolith and there's something for everybody.
Well, I mean, I totally agree with that. And I totally welcome getting this to market safely as quickly as possible, because it has taken a very long time. And one thing I'm sure you find in your research is that lots of people want this. And I you know, there's this sort of, I think there's this myth out there that men don't want to have to deal with contraception. I don't think that's true. And I believe that the research also says that's not true, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So that market research that I mentioned, the United States actually had some of the lowest interest in male contraception.
And
that
really?
Was, I think it was, yeah, it was somewhere around 40% of U.S. men would within 12 months be interested in taking up a new contraceptive method.
That's pretty high, though. That's still pretty high, as the lowest.
That's what I'm saying, is even at the lowest at 40% that's still pretty good, right? When we talk about the sort of market that's out there. And so I think that, you know, for a market perspective, if you can only capture 5, 10, 15% of men out there, that's still a very robust market for you to try and grab onto from a economics perspective. But then more than that, trying to do this from a public health perspective means that if we can get a few options out there, the market, the uptake is there.
Yeah.
We just have to create the options that people can use.
So quickly, Logan, what sort of time frame are we looking at for the commercial versions of these drugs if they pass phase three?
Yeah. So the hormonal gel that I mentioned and the vas occlusive device that I mentioned, there are two of those that are pretty far along in the approvals process. I should say that drugs and devices being regulated very differently have different timelines to approval. So even though the gel is further along in the clinical trials process, it could have a similar time to market as a reversible vasectomy called ATOM, which I mentioned is in clinical trials now.
Okay.
And that's, you know, we're hoping for less than 5 years, I think, for both of those products. But I should really couch this to say that, you know, that's if things go very smoothly. It will require clinical trials that take years of monitoring for pregnancies. Mm-hmm. The very stringent regulatory process is indeed very burdensome.
I would imagine so, because the consequences of it not working, as we all know, are pretty significant. Logan Nichols, Chief Research Officer with the Male Contraceptive Initiative, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
That was mad, wasn't it? Like, it's like, they're all interesting ideas. I'm so glad I'm not in the situation where I have to kind of think so much about that now, because it's all just a bit, it's all so much hassle, isn't it?
Yeah, well, but I mean, we've been free of the hassle as men for
well,
for
I mean,
years.
Like, in some way, like, you know, you use condoms, so that's not free of the hassle.
No, but if it comes to pills or things like that, we haven't been able to take them. I mean, it is hassle, but it's not that, like, it's a big thing. It's not a huge thing to rub your shoulders every so often.
Every day?
Yeah.
With the gel, and I've, like, yeah. I mean, I have tacky shoulders, and I'm sure we have lots of women going, how dare you have it to deal with hormonal blah, blah. Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. But
it might feel a bit weird. Like, when I was, for some reason, when I was doing the research call and he started talking about the rubbing your shoulders, I kind of automatically went to rub my shoulders and ended up doing that thing you used to do with your friends where you're like, look, I'm making out to someone if they're looking from behind. It's like, you can imagine doing that.
It's kind of hard to...
It's a good way to remind you that that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. But it's also a little bit of a weird mental connection. Like, if you do that every day, well, like, like, you know, when you start like, you know, like getting aroused with your person, are you just like subconsciously going to start rubbing yourself in the shoulders and immediately lose any chance of you needing the contraception in the first place?
Well, yeah, not everybody gets aroused by their own person, though, John. I think that might be a
I think they
thing.
Do, Aidan. I think they do. Right. Love to get your thoughts on that. Because, I mean, men absolutely want to be in control. They don't want condom. Condoms are, you know, they are a necessary evil. I think an alternative to that that's long-term would be great. And I think most men would go for it, but I suppose condoms, people... condoms also do the STI thing. Like, I just don't know if I would. I guess if you're in a long-term relationship,
it's in a long, right? mainly a long-term relationship. Yeah.
You got to keep the condoms, folks. Okay. Talking about UFOs, it was kind of a bit of a departure from us on the show last week. I wasn't sure. What do you think?
You were well. It was a good interview. And it was interesting.
It was interesting.
Look, it's science adjacent, and people want.
Welcome to the Future Proof, our science adjacent podcast.
Yeah, but the odd time it's nice that we've had a good few of those over the years where we spread off and something we've had like nuclear war, things like that. You know, they're not necessarily a specifically science piece, but they are of interest to people who are interested in science. I think that's my take on it.
Do you know, it's been a while since we've had one of these texts, so it's almost. Refreshing to get one. We were speaking about UFOs with Greg Gigian, who is a historian who looked at, you know, why they hang around, why the myth hangs around of UFOs. And Jim Indrada says, Jonathan, apart from the GC or GW agenda, I presume that's global warming. What's GC?
Global climate
or global. It depends on the years about UFOs. They are the fallen angels in the Bible or the Book of Enoch. Read your Bible. UFOs are all over it. By the way, the fallen angels got into a lot of trouble for playing around with DNA. And then it just has this number after it. 10565. Is that, because I don't think that's a verse in the Bible. That's a code. This is a Da Vinci situation right now, right? Yeah, figure something out.
105. You know what I've just realized? It could be 105. No, that wouldn't make any sense.
Why so cryptic? Why are these Bible quote people so cryptic? Jim, I don't know what you mean. I actually am intrigued that UFOs are all over the Bible.
I went to Catholic school and never once did anyone mention a UFO. I might have paid more attention to
it. But maybe it's fallen angels is code for UFO.
Maybe. Perhaps.
Who knows? Tell Jonathan's guest that I think the population of the world are being prepped for the announcement of the UFOs and aliens visiting planet Earth. Okay, we've got a few of these. How many of these did we get? Okay, here we go. This is actually a good few of them. Do you know what? I didn't think we had UFO people in Ireland, but we do.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what? That's great. I love it. Like, why not? And absolutely, when you think about aliens, I absolutely believe they're aliens. Do I believe they're flying around? No, but they could be.
They could be.
Could be. Prove me wrong. Someone says, hi, Jonathan, you seem very ill-informed on the topic of UFOs. That's because it's science-adjacent. It's a science-adjacent topic.
Once you
That's
go out of those delineative lines of science, I'm gone.
They are 100% real.
Jonathan knows nothing outside of science.
Exactly. What is that? It's a duck. They are 100% real. I myself saw one in 1993. Now, UFO means unidentified flying object, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I saw a UFO.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah. I have seen a UFO and then undid the U. I eyed it and then it became an IFO.
So what? Oh, yeah. So what happened?
I had a UFO.
Yeah.
I had a UFO moment. I was in France and I was walking with my family and I looked up and I saw this string of lights above me and like really low and like, holy moly. I was looking at it going, that can't be a satellite. Like there's 50 of them. Like that, what is that? I hadn't seen photographs of anything like it. It was a UFO, right? And I was walking along this thing in France. I was on holiday with my family. And I kind of said, can you see that? Like I was saying to people, like a mad person. Honestly, I was like, this is crazy.
They're coming.
I said this to this cool French couple, like he had a gitan in his mouth and they were sitting with their feet in the water. Like, and he was, you know, they were just so super cool. So cool for school that when I said, can you see the UFOs? He was like, he just turned to look at me and then just didn't say a word, didn't look up at me frantically waving in French at the sky, pointing at the sky. He didn't even crane his neck an extra 30 degrees to point at the thing I was very excited about. He just looked at the girl and went back to talking to her. I was like, man, these Frenchies are cool.
Hey, when the UFOs come, he'll be first against the wall.
Well, I then went, we've got to figure this out. So we went back home and it was a Starlink. But like, if you haven't seen a Starlink before, and really low, the angle of it was so low, I was thinking, that's way too low for it to be. But obviously it just started, these had just started their release at maybe the angle at which I was looking at it made it look like it was a lot lower. But I have to say, it was quite the spectacle. 50 yeah. satellites in a string. Amazing.
Yeah. I've actually seen, it's funny, like I've seen a UFO two different occasions in my life. I think this might say something about people's mind frame when they see UFOs. So when I was a kid, I was very interested in UFOs and I saw two, and I have witnesses for the second one, two other witnesses of my friends who saw these things that we couldn't explain. Then I didn't see a UFO for like 20 years. Then I saw the documentary, I Know What I Saw. Have you ever seen it? Like, it's good crack. And in it, though, the guy who makes the documentary has a line where he's saying, like, you know, you're kind of primed. Like, you probably have seen, most people probably have seen something in the sky. And because they don't believe in aliens or UFOs, they just dismiss it. But if you think about it and you make yourself aware of what you're seeing and you notice the things that are odd, you'll suddenly see that there are lots of things in the sky, right? So that I saw that. And since that, watching that documentary, whatever, 5 years ago, I've three times since seen a UFO. Now, I don't think that necessarily means anything about them being aliens, but I definitely saw something, and I think that's interesting.
Saw something I can't quite explain.
Something I can't explain, but there's lots of things I can't explain, so that doesn't mean a lot.
Yeah.
But two of them were the thing that was in the videos, you know, that the Pentagon released, you know, that little circular thing that's going really close across water. But from the plane, I saw them.
So, no way.
Yeah, no, I don't know what they are. It could be just, you know, it could have just been a drop of water doing something weird. It could be anything.
Could be anything. Could be aliens, though. Anyway, to continue on this email. Hi, Jonathan. You seem very ill-informed on the topic of UFOs. I apologize. They are 100% real. I myself saw one in 1993. Look up the findings of the French Gapan Cometa report on UFOs. Their conclusion is that they are a real phenomenon. That's not what they said.
No, that's not.
It's absolutely not what they said. What they said, and I've never heard of this organization, but often, like, we get sent on this little trail from emails. Look this up, look that up. And we always do, just for the crack.
Yeah.
So Cometa is an association of specialists in physics, life sciences and human sciences, as well as engineers. In 1999, they published a very detailed report about UFOs that was given to President and Prime Minister. According to this report, the hypothesis of an extraterrestrial origin of UFOs can no longer be ruled out. And it says it doesn't forbid any hypothesis, it just gathers facts. So it basically says, could be, but we don't know.
Yeah. And that's from their website.
Yeah. That's from their website. It basically says, we don't know.
Yeah.
So I don't think it says the conclusion is that they're a real phenomenon. I don't think that's a bit of a stretch.
Could be and are very different things.
Shane Carroll says, World War II fighter pilots and UFOs are rabbit holes that I've gone down. The Allies pilots called them Foo Fighters. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Foo Fighters comes from Allies fighter pilots seeing UFOs. They call them Foo Fighters.
Yeah, the better of the two Foo Fighters.
Yeah, exactly. There are lots of rabbit holes to go down. You should have a go, says Shane. I have.
Yeah,
I have
done
many times. Yeah,
exactly. Every week.
You make me do
lovely
that.
Lovely listeners.
Well, thanks very much for your time and attention this week. Thanks to Simon Keane, Aidan McKelvey, Rory Galvin, and Hugo de Silva on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.